He is Robin Leach. This is Car Keys.
And I am going solo this week. For those who are listening, Jay DeMarkin, my co-host, is out of the country for a week or so, and we'll be back maybe with or maybe with not anything major new about what's going on in the European car scene. But what's going on in the American car scene is notable for a couple of brands which we talk about often on this show, and the first one is Tesla, because Elon Musk was in some interview a few days ago, before this show is done, talking about the upgrades or not upgrades of the Tesla company going forward. One notable one is this Cybertruck, which has been ballyhooed about for 2 or 3 years now, is on hold for yet another at least 1 or 2 years. 2023 is now the next scheduled sort of debut of this truck. I think Tesla is finding themselves rather overstretched in a number of areas. The Cybertruck has certainly been controversial from one standpoint in the first debut of the debut of the first version of it, when the so-called shatterproof windshields shattered in a demonstration on the stage where it was introduced to the press. And I don't know whether it's going to actually come with bulletproof glass or not when it finally shows up, but it's no doubt going to have evolved a bit. I have yet to see the newest visual version of it. Apparently there's one around, so it may or may not look like the radical design that was first introduced, although I suspect Elon Musk will try to keep the radical design going forward, with maybe some modifications to the rear pickup bed area. But Tesla fans, you're going to have to wait longer. And I don't know what happens to those of you who have put down, if there are any in this listing area, put down deposits on a Cybertruck. I suspect Elon Musk has been spending through those deposits, even though I think they're supposed to be in an escrow account held in case you want your deposit back. But
do you have any sense of how many people are getting their money back?
I don't know that anybody. I have seen no article showing that people are starting to.
Do you know anybody
who's deposits back?
Do you know anyone who has ordered them?
No, I do not.
Okay, so.
But you know, there is a lot going on with deposits for future vehicles. The Ford electric pickup has got so many deposits on it that they have stopped taking new orders because they can't produce anywhere near the number of trucks that have been had. $100 or $500 or $1,000 deposits put down on them. And that is also the case for the Rivian pickup truck, although Rivian's trying to ramp up production. But this is the problem. You have exciting new projects or products coming, and a lot of people get really ramped up about them. The Bronco was certainly one of them until they had a stall in the hardtop production versions, because the hardtops were coming out of off the assembly line for the trucks in some kind of chemically defective condition. I believe that's been worked out. Well, let's go to Bronco for a product discussion, because the Bronco has, for pickup fans, Ford pickup truck fans, has had a version of the pickup called the Raptor, which has been wildly successful if you can afford it, since it seems to run somewhere in the $70,000 range and upward if you have to go out and buy a new one. And Ford, and it's, in my opinion on this Bronco situation, and I wrote in one of the blogs my comment, and I got quite a bit of support from it, is going to produce a Raptor edition of the Bronco, and they have shown initial pictures of it. One of the things about the original Bronco, of which I owned two of them, was their size. Relatively compact compared to the newest version, at least in the two-door trim, which is all they came in back then when I owned them. There was no four-door Bronco ever in the early versions. Was their relative flexibility and mobility in trail riding or trail running, which means not bounding over desert, wide open desert spaces, which is how they show the Raptor versions of the Ford pickup and the Raptor version of the Bronco forthcoming, in promotion materials. And my instant comment on the blog, which I commented on, and I can't remember where it was that this new Raptor version is apparently going to be 6 inches wider than the existing new Bronco version. Beefier tires yet. It's going to have a super strong suspension underneath, which all Raptor versions of the pickup trucks do. All designed to make this car be able to bound, making leaping bounds over dunes, potholes, rough trail surfaces. What it does not allow you to do is go take something like this on a Rubicon Trail type of adventure, although they'll figure it out somehow, they'll move the rocks around or whatever to make the Raptor version of the Bronco Rubicon Trail ready. But I'm not sure it will be able to go on the Rubicon Trail. And I commented in my blog that, it was a comment line, that this was a ridiculous version of the Bronco to make, because what it was doing is it was doing the usual, well, we have it now, let's build it a little bit bigger, thinking we're going to make it a little bit better because that's what Americans want. Well, there's going to be a certain component of buyers that are going to want to buy a Raptor version of the Bronco, but it's not going to be anybody who wants to take them through wooded trails, narrow passageways, and some of these off-road trails that are quite numerous, apparently, out in the west part of our country, because they're not going to be able to get through these narrower passages. What you do when you make a vehicle wider, such as they're doing with the Bronco Raptor, and they did even with the pickup truck, is that they widen the axles, they put fatter, bigger tires on, they put flared fenders on, all of which adds to the width of a vehicle, which is already wide enough. I've driven the current one. It's wonderful in its size, but it's not. It's still not as agile as the old original 69 Bronco was. As is the same thing has happened to the Jeep Wranglers. They've gotten wider too, and some of it's probably safety related because the narrower the track of the vehicle, the more prone it is to being able to tip over if you're driving it recklessly and trying to do zigzag turning and that kind of thing, and or you're on a side hill where narrow axles are not going to be as roll-resistant or tip-over-resistant as wide axles are going to be. And, of course, when you put raised suspensions on these vehicles, you raise the center of gravity on them as well. And so what they're doing is they're making a very attractive-looking added model to the Bronco, theoretically, in Raptor form, that a certain number of buyers will probably buy because that will suit their ego just fine. But it's going to make it much less agile in a lot of trail instances where many of the new Bronco models will be seen, if at all, meaning something like the Rubicon Trail and or narrower trails that are prevalent in many of these off-road trails that you can find with apps and through Jeep, actually through Jeep apps right now. I just discovered it going forward. And the Jeep Wrangler people have got the same issue with their Wranglers because their axles are wider than the old narrow ones of 10 or 12 years ago. This Bronco's going to sell probably fine for Ford, but I'm not sure that they're going to get anywhere near the numbers of people wanting to buy the Raptor version of a Bronco as they are getting buying the Ford pickup truck, which is not used off-road necessarily. That's my comment on that. This show is being recorded a few days after what I call somewhat of a week in our listening area, nor'easter snowstorm, which hit much of the eastern coast part of this country over the days that it occurred. We, unfortunately, fortunately for many listeners, I'm sure, only got, well, what appears to be 4 to 6 inches of at least snow that is now still on the ground at right around in my listening area, as opposed to the 18 to 24 inches, which was found, and maybe more in some cases, found along the east coast of this country in the days that it occurred. Actually, it was a one-day storm. But this gets to this point of how do you drive in such storms if you are supposed to be able to drive at all. Massachusetts initiated, I think Rhode Island also, a ban on any non-emergency use driving during the day of the storm hitting. And I know I-95 along the coast was banned trucks all day Saturday, I think, if not in the morning. Much of the day, they were banning tractor trailers from being on the roads, on I-95 at least, if not other roads around. But what is important in a storm that creates a fair amount of snowfall is that you need to have tires. If you really want to have tires that'll make you go in the snow, many of the tire compounds that cars come with, if they're not off-road capable right off the bat, are not suitable for driving in deep snow from the standpoint of giving you good traction. I have two Jeeps, Cherokees, and one of them I bought a special set of winter tires and put them on rims so that I could swap out the road tires for winter treaded tires for storms just like we had, although we didn't have it in any kind of form that would have made a whole lot of difference for many of us don't do that kind of thing. But the compounds made for real snowstorm areas are softer rubber and a different kind of tread pattern, which often has side sipes in the tires themselves, which allow a certain amount of grip beyond the grip that is touching the road all the time. It doesn't really make that much of a difference in most of the storms we have around our listening area winter after winter because we're not having major storms. But in places like Vermont and Maine, which or any place that gets a deeper snowpack than a lesser snowpack when the storm comes and goes, makes you want to have tires that really will get you moving if you're on a hill or a side, you know, any kind of road that's slippery, but more slippery with snow than ice. Ice is a different factor. You don't need deep treaded tires for ice because I don't think deep treaded tires grip ice any better than any treaded tires do as long as they've got a good tread. Those tires are going to slip during braking or during acceleration. And whether you have, unless you have studded winter tires, which are a major difference than non-studded tires, for example, in that there are metal studs, or I guess there's probably now plastic compounded studs, which stick out a little bit from the tread surfaces of tires and actually do grip on ice better than non-studded tires. But what you need to do in these storms, for sure, no matter what you have on your car for tires, is to drive a whole lot slower on curves and going down hills and coming to stop signs at the bottom of descending hills when they meet another highway at the bottom. Because if you can't stop your car safely, you could slide right out, for example, in a descending hill that stops at the bottom. We have several around our listing area. You could slide right out onto possibly cars coming down the road that you're T-boning into or teeing into. And there's not much that's going to stop you safely if you're going over a safe speed on any roads that have snow, any roads that have ice, and any roads to my way of thinking that have a lot of sand at the bottom which is to try to help you to stop. But I have been down some of these hills with which have been amply sanded, and if you're going too fast, the sand is going to slide not as easily as you're going to slide on top of snow or ice, but the sand itself, if it's thick, will slide under your tires as you're braking and could allow you to slide right out into a highway that you ordinarily would not want to slide out onto. And if there were cars coming either direction, you could find yourself in big trouble. It's a sort of a safety situation about talking about driving in snowstorms. Jill, I don't know what you had for road conditions up where you live on...
Well, the usual, but it's quite interesting because there are certain, no matter what, if there is ice and your tire meets ice...
You don't stop very well, do you?
No.
No.
And it was interesting being behind someone. You know, I've got all-wheel drive. I was behind a truck with four-wheel drive, but it doesn't, you know, really doesn't make a bit of difference.
It does not.
There was something, about the...
Well, the weight of the car will make a difference also, both in trying to get going and also in stopping. The heavier the vehicle, the longer it's going to take to stop, and more moving force forward will keep it moving forward as opposed to a lighter car. On the other hand, weight can be an advantage in that you may be more firmly planted on whatever road surface you are dealing with at the moment. But if you're on an incline, and we're talking about really going downhill at whichever way the road's going, going downhill is the problem. You really have to modulate your braking and speed much more in a safety fashion than you might ordinarily think when you have a vehicle of greater weight. And also, tires don't turn very well when they're... With anti-lock braking, which is what we have in just about every car now that's not over 10 years old or 15 years old maybe by this time, can also be equivalent to anti-stop braking. And I've talked to a couple of people who didn't know much about anti-lock braking until they found that it didn't stop them very well when they were coming to a stop sign at the bottom of one of these descending hills that we have around here. And they, in fact, did find themselves, at least the hood part of their car, going out into a road that they were trying to stop in front of before they actually were able to get to a stop. And they didn't understand the situation about anti-lock brakes, which do not stop the tires completely because they're designed to allow you to keep steering while you brake, which is a safer situation in most cases, but not in all. And the not in all part is when you want to have tires stop, because a skidded stop tire may often stop more quickly or stop you sooner than an anti-lock braking system, because it'll keep the tire rolling, which means it lengthens the amount of distance that it takes for the car to come to a complete safe stop in the anti-lock braking terms. That is not very well known. People, it's amazing how many people haven't a clue what anti-lock brakes are until they first find out that they work in a certain way. And sometimes they don't realize that when you have an anti-lock braking system in your car, in 95% of the time, you really do want to have the anti-lock braking working, and you want to keep your foot hard on the pedal, as opposed to when you feel the vibration, which usually happens the first time somebody feels it actually working. They tend to think something's wrong with the brakes, and they may actually take their foot off the brakes because they don't know what's going on beneath their foot.
Yeah, I think that most people are not either familiar. It's hard to know. You know, it's almost as though you can now divide people into categories: people who drive and people who. In people who are engaged in the driving and people who just aren't. And if you're dealing with the first group, then they have some clue. And if you're dealing with the second group, they kind of don't. And what I wonder is if they even, you know, really care.
I don't know whether they care. They don't care until something happens, and then they suddenly figure out that they need to learn about something they didn't know.
Right.
In their car, vehicle, or in their driving habits. I want to go back to Tesla. I go sort of digress.
All right, you got a couple of minutes
because of the snowstorm that was recently had around our area. Tesla was also planning a $25,000 model, which is now I think on permanent hold, if not been parked on the shelf, because I think Elon Musk is discovering that it's not really economically feasible from a profit central standpoint to build a $25,000 Tesla, because the technology, while it's getting cheaper for in the terms of the battery costs and maybe some other areas, is not going to be cheap enough for him to make quite a bit of money on each car, which he's doing very well, very nicely with his Model Y, Model S, Model 3, and the other ones that are currently in production. Tesla has got a very successful car, but a line of cars, in my opinion. I think Jay would agree. But there are others online coming online fairly quickly that aren't getting the heralded press that Tesla keeps getting. Porsche's got them. Audi's got them. BMW's got them. Hyundai's got them all over the place. Toyota, we talked about Toyota in a recent show. It's got a very good lineup of both plug-ins and full electric vehicles now. I've been touting the plug-in hybrid as the best combination form of hybrid vehicle to get if you are driving a lot. But as range anxiety lessens, diminishes, that is, and battery, let's say battery strength gets greater, or battery power becomes more efficient per whatever it is you measure battery power with, people aren't going to worry about, you know, they already don't worry about if they don't drive more than 200 or 250 miles a day, they don't worry about range anxiety at all. And we see many Teslas around this corner of our listening area, and actually all over the state of Connecticut right now, which I drive through a lot of weekly, as well as other states. So it's proof that electric cars are now becoming more acceptable in many people's minds, although there are lots of minds out there that have no interest in electric cars yet. I have an interest in them, but I don't have an interest in owning one going forward. But as ranges are creeping up towards 300 miles or grip greater, which is what I've always thought and have been stating on these shows was a necessary range in an average condition. We all know that cold weather diminishes range in all kinds of hybrid vehicles, whether they be full electric or plug-in electric.
Do we know what it diminishes it to? And by the way, we've got about 20 seconds left.
Yeah, okay. Well, to close, plug-in hybrids still are the favorite in my book because you're not dependent upon having to plug in a plug-in hybrid between because it's got a gasoline engine that kicks in when the battery part of it kicks out. And therefore, you don't have to worry except for the size of your gas tank. And you therefore can drive a hybrid 450 miles if you've got a big enough gas tank, and the hybrid range is very excellent to boot. Okay?
Okay. He is Robin Leach. This is Car Keys.